from algae living in it. Why aren't clouds green? So from that, I conclude, you know, rather simple-minded and maybe a little too glib, that there's not a thriving ecosystem of photosynthetic organisms in the cloud, even though there's liquid water, there's dissolved nutrients, and there's plenty of sunlight.
The requirements for life, as far as we understand it, and this is only applies to the life that we do know, because we don't know about the life we don't know,
right. Is
water and an energy source. We can say that much about life.
And some nutrients, obviously, carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus. So life's got to have, it's got to have a liquid to live in, it's got to have bricks to make itself, chemicals, and it's got to have an energy source. This is pretty a general requirement, I would think.
Although NASA's mantra for hunting for life off of Earth is not follow the nutrients, it's really follow the water.
Right. And the reason why follow the water is such a useful strategy is because liquid water is what's rare. When we look on Earth, liquid water is plentiful. It's everywhere. But Earth is very unusual. When we look beyond Earth, we see lots of energy, sunlight streaming through the solar system. We see lots of nutrients, carbon everywhere, nitrogen everywhere. What we don't see a lot of is liquid water. So that's what seems to be the missing ingredient.
Well, finally, Chris, we began the show with a discussion of the Viking experiments and the debate that is still going on in some circles of whether or not they did detect life. Would you like to weigh in on that and also give us an update of how that search for life on Mars has changed in the 40 years since?
Yeah, I think the question of did Viking find life on Mars is an important one. And from a science point of view, I would say it's unlikely. It's not a hypothesis that we should follow up on scientifically. But now if you put on another hat and say, well, what about human health and safety? What about sending astronauts there? Do they have to worry about infection? Well, that's a whole different level of certainty. We better be cautious.
So this isn't the case of the known unknowns. It's a case of the certain uncertainties.
That's right. This is a case of uncertainties and how you weigh them. And you weigh them differently if you're doing science versus if you're doing precautionary astronaut health and safety.
Chris McKay, it's always a pleasure to have you join us. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Chris McKay is a planetary scientist at the NASA Ames Research Center.
Thanks to the lively trio who helped produce the show, senior producer Gary Niederhoff, operations manager Barbara Vance, and intern Daniel Marino.
Thanks also to financial support from Rena Shulsky David and Sammy David, and to the William K. Bose Jr. Foundation. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit scientific and education organization whose scientists study the origin and nature of life, including whether there really is life beneath the dry sands of Mars. And a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to the Big Picture Science episode, Frog's Pants. If you want to hear more Big Picture Science episodes, no need to theorize about how to find them. They exist in our archive at bigpicturescience.org.
And if you're a podcast listener but prefer listening to over-the-air radio because you think it beats the pants off podcasting, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station is not on that list, consider letting them know you like the show. Oh, and to reach us directly with your comments, throw in some faint praise, and then email it all to bigpicturescience@seti.org.
I'm thinking it's time that we had a little boy now. Anthea, add another pinch of cardamom to my blood pudding.
Yes, dear.
Meanwhile, I'll chop an extra 2 cords of wood. I want this boy to have character.
Arr, ahoy me hearties. This be WHFR Dearborn. This be the station that be making waves, and you can take that from Pierre Lafitte the pirate. Arr.
The views and opinions expressed on the following pre-recorded show do not necessarily represent those of WHFR or Henry Ford College. Thank you. Good afternoon. This is WHFR Dearborn. You're listening to the show called Metaphysically Speaking. I'm your host, Mike Holloway. And this month, my special guest is Reverend Gregory Geis. He is the senior minister of Detroit Unity Temple and an author. Throughout his life, he has been a counselor, teacher, and social worker in the Detroit area. Along the way, he has received many honors, including Michiganian of the Year from the Detroit News in 2008. Good afternoon, Reverend Geis. How are you?
I'm positive, and thank you for inviting me to be on your wonderful program. It's an honor for me to be here, so thank you.
Well, thank you for being here. I do appreciate it. Now, judging from the introduction I just gave, you've been a counselor, a teacher, a social worker. Obviously, you like to work with people. Is this true?
Oh, all my life. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a very, very something I'm very proud of, but it also goes back to the fact that I've always been blessed to have other people who've worked with me. Sometimes it's sort of a way of giving it forward. So I've been blessed to have good men and women who have been involved in my life, and that's how it worked. You give back to what was given to you, and I've been blessed to have many great teachers and individuals who have assisted in my life going forward, and I'm just grateful to give back to others as way it was given to me.
Mm-hmm. And what led you to become a minister in the Unity religion, movement, whatever you might want to call it?
Well, I have to say that it was many factors, because I never intended on becoming a minister, even though my mother may have prophesied it.
Oh, really?
I always knew I was wanted to be a teacher or public servant. And then I guess after many years of teaching, because I've taught Head Start, I've taught in high school, I've taught in the parochial system, and I've been very active as a community servant or community leader, activist. And then one day, at being at Detroit Unity Temple, my minister, Reverend Argentina Glasgow, simply asked me the question, had I ever thought about becoming a minister? And at that particular time, there was a program called the Urban Ministerial School, and I decided to get involved, which was led by Reverend Ruth Mosley, and I got involved, and next thing you know, I was on my way. But it came after just several years of serving, being involved in SCLC, being involved in programs in the Detroit area that was leading up to it. And I have to say, if it wasn't for young people who I was counseling, because I was a clinical psychologist first, and they used to say, Mr. Geis, you always preaching to us. Mr. Geis, you always trying to tell us what to do. So I was preaching before I knew it, and finally those young people telling me that I was preaching and counseling and ministering, I decided I might as well go where I'm being called to go.
Right, you saw the light at that point, right? I mean, just by virtue of the fact that it's interesting, they obviously saw something in you and kind of reinforced that, and then you just said, well, that light bulb went off and said, well, maybe I should follow this up. So you entered into the training program?
Yes.
And how was that?
Well, the Urban Ministerial School was an area where, you know, sometimes you always look for something that you feel that you were called to do, because I was always going to be involved in the community. And I'm the grandson of a Baptist minister. And my grandfather back in Birmingham, Alabama, was very much involved in ministry. He worked directly with Dr. King when he was in Birmingham, mm-hmm. those years in the 60s. My mother was a very strong minister. You can say a person very involved in ministry herself. So that spiritual connection was always there. And so I just tended to have directed it towards community. And I always was very much involved. What Unity offered me, though, was the metaphysical aspect, because I always wanted something deeper than just the traditional fundamentalist aspect of spiritual or ministry. Unity offered me something a little deeper where I could go towards something I was always seeking. And going to Unity provided me that outlet, that search for truth, which fed me where I was. Once I found that, it opened the door where I was able to go towards being a Unity minister. And that was critical for my search for truth. So that came together when I just found Unity, which opened the door to become a Unity minister.
Mm-hmm. And once you got, was it a degree that you received?
I actually received I became licensed and orientated, and not necessarily a degree, because I had already had my master's in clinical psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went into the Urban Ministerial School, I became licensed and ordained in Unity Ministerial School.
Mm-hmm. Well, once you did that, where did that lead? What was your first position?
Once I got ordained in the year 2000, I wound up going to Fort Wayne, Indiana, where my first church was at. And that was a wonderful place. I think the person where I went, he must have been shocked because I showed up at his house and I had 30 box of books that came with me.
That's a heavy load.
30 box of books. And it was, but it was a fantastic place to go to. It was called Unity of Fort Wayne. And there is where I also met my wife, Francine Geis. I'm going to have to say, you know, she was a blessing to meet. But it opened the door for me to begin my ministerial experience and to find out what truly what ministry was about in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And I really got involved and met great people, but I found out what I was able to bring and offer into a wonderful community in Fort Wayne. As you know, Fort Wayne was a home of the Detroit Pistons.
Yes, originally, yes, right. Yeah, Solners, was it?
Yeah,
Pistons? Yeah, something like that anyway. But yeah, they obviously made it to Detroit, which very apropos name for Detroit, you know, the Pistons. But now, when you follow through with that, how long were you there in Fort
Wayne? I was
there
for 5 years. And it was a great opportunity because we created a program called Unity of Love Family Reconnect. We got involved with the reentry program. If you remember, that's when 9/11 took place. Mm-hmm. So we were able to come together as a community and began to get actively involved in the community there after 9/11. And we pulled several community organizations together of different faith-based orientations, but we put together something called Unity of Love Family Reconnect. There we worked with prison returning citizens and helped them reconnect within their lives. And that was something that was very positive. We also got involved with the Negro Baseball League that was in, you know, Kansas City and began mm-hmm. to build. And Buck O'Neill, who was a Negro baseball player.
Right.
And worked with their minor league baseball team. And so we got very involved in the community in Fort Wayne and built a strong community relationship with that and through our community organization, Unity of Love Family Reconnect, working with returning citizens. We got involved with the Community Correction Agency. So we were able to build a community grassroots organization through Unity there and build an working with faith-based organizations of all sorts and build a wonderful grassroots organization.
Mm-hmm. And from there, where did you go?
From there, I came back to Detroit. Got involved with Detroit when with here for the first time from 2005 to 2008 and stayed here for 3 years. Then I went up to Lake Orion, Michigan, and stayed up there for another 5 years and came back to Detroit Unity Temple in 2011, where I'm currently still serving.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long have you been the senior minister?
When I came back in 2005, I served as a co-minister with Reverend Argentina Glasgow, and I also got married in 2005 to Francine, my current wife. But when we went to Lake Orion, served up there, but we came back here, and I took over the full reign of Detroit Unity Temple in 2011 as their senior minister. And I've been senior minister since 2011.
Mm-hmm. What is your mission at that church? What would you say that is?
The mission at Detroit Unity Temple, I would say to assist the individuals and to grow, to be a part of Detroit Unity Temple. We put a tagline on there. It says, Detroit Unity Temple, an institute for higher spiritual learning, to assist individuals to achieving their highest spiritual potential. It's almost, I'm sure, like they do right here at Henry Ford College, to help students to achieve their highest spiritual educational potential. But I would say there, to help individuals achieve their highest spiritual potential, mm-hmm. helping them to rise to or to discover truly their spiritual growth and spiritual identity, mm-hmm. helping them to discover that presence of God within themselves, mm-hmm. if they choose to use that term, or that unfoldment of their spiritual qualities.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is your role at the church? I mean, what are your responsibilities?
My role at the church is not only to teach, but to facilitate in that development, and as well as working with the community. We are still a very strong, active, spiritual presence in that community. We work directly with what is called People for Palmer Park, the 12th Precinct. We're very much involved with our youth. We have a strong youth program. I'm excited to talk about our youth program. at President Obama's second inauguration, we was very much involved with sending close to 50 young people to President Obama's inauguration. Mm-hmm. That's something to feel proud with. And the students who graduate, we gave them close to $1,500 apiece.
Wow, that's a lot.
And each one of them had to join the church, do quality service in terms of community service and service around the church. And those young people, we wanted them to realize that they are a high priority of being part of our church. They can do active community service. And we also have a program called, that's a member of our church, Alma Greer, who does things, has a program within the church that's called Legacy of Literacy, where we go into the community in Highland Park and into the Detroit areas. We have what is called Real Men Read program, where we go into the school system with the men of our community and help young men read. We also have Real Women Read. We go back into Highland Park and or into Detroit and help young women, young girls, children read. So these young children, students in elementary school, kindergarten, first, second, third grade, or fourth grade, have young adult, have adults, men and women, read with them. So they can see adults reading with them who are not just their teachers. Mm-hmm. And having that opportunity with a Real Men Read program, a Real Women program read. And that is spectacular because so many young people need to be inspired and realize that reading is a number one priority. So
yes.
Our student activity, the other thing we did was we adopted last few years a school called Palmer Park Preparatory Academy. And we went into that school volunteering and did a direct volunteerism throughout that school. And that was our commitment. And I was over there as well helping to mentor young people in that school setting. And that was something we continued to do. Being a part of People for Palmer Park, we also were there to help adopt Palmer Park as a school. So our small children in our, what we call our educational system, divided what we call our children's church, our youth, our what they call unit teens, which are our middle school area, and our YOU, our children's church, went over to the park and helped with a raised garden. They have a garden over there in Palmer Park, and they helped to grow food, grow crop, and children had a chance to get their hands dirty.
Yeah, you know, they probably liked that.
Oh,
right?
They loved it.
Yeah, well, no, that's great, especially the reading part. I think that's very, very important. And if you can get children to read, I think that's a definite plus in anybody's life.
Oh, it's, you know, I do believe any spiritual community, faith-based organization, has to be a part of the community that they serve. And so often a faith-based organization, no matter what faith, tends to be just closed within the walls themselves and only serve the community of its membership.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're living in that community, you can do more than just serve your community that you're within your walls. You can reach out. Can you imagine if every church extended that their community to network and to partner with those other faith-based organizations in that neighborhood and build a bridge of support with each other? Then all of a sudden that community become enriched. It's not about the faith-based organization. It becomes a relationship that you have. If where you may have some neighborhood, it may have four churches on a single square block area. Mm-hmm. But one church can mentor in math, another church can mentor in reading, another church can mentor in just providing a safe home, safe gathering, or parenting classes. Together we can change that square block area, working together, providing a place for kids to come.
Mm-hmm.
And we can find a way to agree on what our faith may differ in. We can agree to come together around the things we agree on and not necessarily be different. So, and it could be your Islamic faith, it could be my Christian-based faith, it could be, or my unity faith, but it could be something we can agree on if it's just agreeing that we love our children together.
Mm-hmm. That's very important. Once again, I just want to remind everybody that this is WHFR.FM, the station making waves. This show is Metaphysically Speaking. I'm your host, Mike Holloway. My special guest this month is Reverend Gregory Geis. He is a senior minister of Detroit Unity Temple and an author. Now, going back to what you were just saying about working together, that would be phenomenal. And the energy, if people could do that, because I think what you mentioned earlier, a lot of churches do just service the members that come to the church. They don't always work around the community. But if we could harness that power sometimes, I think that would be a phenomenal thing. I mean, and the fact, like you said, if you can work together, you can have that ripple effect and just affect blacks and blacks and blacks. Is this what you feel?
Oh, yes. I say that enthusiastically. I know there's a Latter-day Saints church directly across the street. When a program comes around, such as Arise Detroit, we work and partner with them to put together a book bag program. We share together and give out book bags and other things together. There's times when there's Grace Baptist Church, which is on 6 Mile and Second, and we work directly with them. We have a parking lot. When they want to utilize it, we let them utilize it. And there's other churches that's in our area. We want to form a ecumenical faith-based organization together, and we are all different faith orientations. The key is that we serve that community together. There are enough lost souls or individuals around us that we can work together. There are crisis issues that we can work together. I remember one year, a few years back, when we marched together in that area to talk about stopping crime together, and we pulled ourselves together. I appreciate the Latter-day Saints. We own a building directly across the street from us. The Latter-day Saints, their president, Cleveland Williams, he sent his volunteers, their members who are volunteering, to help us paint our building. And that was out of the kindness of their heart. And said, if we ever need their volunteers, just let them know. Mm-hmm. We recently just turned 100 years old, our ministry, and they came along and extended themselves. You know, this is an example of what happens when faith-based organizations decided to work together. And in that little small area around Palmer Park, it's a direct example of what happens when people, regardless of faith orientation, come together, or racial orientation, come together and say, yes, we can, and yes, we can make this happen. And that becomes the catalyst for changing our community, changing Detroit. We don't have to be in Midtown to talk about changing Detroit. We can change Detroit right where we're at.
Right. Right, that's very important. Start where you stand, right?
Yes, sir.
More or less.
Wherever I stand is holy ground.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a great philosophy right there. What are some of the other things that you're responsible for at the church? I mean, obviously, you probably give the lesson every Sunday, and is that something that you do every Sunday?
No, I have a wonderful associate minister by the name of Carol Amos. She has been in the Urban Ministerial School that I graduated out of. She was one of the first individual that graduated through the Urban Ministerial School, and she's my right hand. She's my associate minister. She also is responsible to spiritual education. We have a team philosophy, so we don't operate out of a pyramid. Mm-hmm. I take on the spiritual educational responsibility, and the board, I have a wonderful board that works directly with me, that takes on its fiduciary responsibilities. But my responsibility is to make sure that the educational, and I serve as that spiritual CEO, that would take the head, but I sit down with a body of individuals, and we collectively will sort of chart out the direction that it will go. But when it comes to the spiritual education, we are what you may call a new thought organization. Well, I want to make sure that our spiritual growth, our spiritual direction, is being fed and it's in alignment with what the direction of unity and its growth aspect, or what unity principles are all about. Our unity principles are designed on the effort to make individuals realize. So I want to make sure that people understand what that backbone is, like very similar to what Eric Butterworth talked about, or what the writers or the thoughts behind Charles Fillmore about, or the whole idea of recognizing that there exists within us a power that is so great within us that will help us lift up. So you won't have me encouraging people to think about lack or worry or hell and damnation, but to think about the fact that there is a greatness inside of us that will inspire us to achieve no matter what we're facing, and not get trapped in some words, some old, Lord, please help us, we're going down and drain a negative thought. No. So my responsibility is like maintaining the rudder of a ship that's sailing a course, and we set sail for a direction. And so I can hold that rudder very steady and putting other individuals on that ship that we're going forward. And even when the waves get rough, we still will hold that rudder as we go forward to our highest degree and our highest effort and our highest good, and knowing that we have all the stuff we need right inside of us.
So you have great teamwork.
Oh, we got to. You get rough sometimes.
Oh, yeah, right. That, rough waters, you never know, man. You got to, like you say, you know, just keep going steadily and hang on and hope and for the best sometimes.
And we got great music, too. That's
Well, that's great. A great choir, I assume?
Gwen and Charles Scales are our music directors.
Oh, wow.
And we have Gwen and Charles Scales. Are you familiar with Gwen and Charles?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Charles Scales and Gwen Scales serve as our music directors. And so on Monday, our first Sunday is filled with young people who come together, and we are called our Praise Monday team. We have a young man by the name of Sean Townsend. Charles Scales' daughter once handled the first Sunday service, Lauren Scales. Our second Sunday, we have what is called our Praise team, who are men of praise, and he put together these six men, and they sound like Take Six. They come in, and Sandra Bomar, and she has a wonderful voice with Spin Anderson, and they put together a wonderful team. At times, she would bring Tony Campoletti in there, and they put together, as a matter of fact, they have a concert coming up on March 31st, and then the fourth Sunday, Gwen and Charles normally take, and the fifth Sunday, we had called our Youth Sunday, and we have our adult choir where Nina Scott comes in. She put together a wonderful adult choir. And then our youth take over. I have a young host, one of our youth members. Our youth do the meditation. Our children's church do a praise dance. We have our youth and our adults. We have an intergenerational service our fifth Sunday, from praise dancing to youth meditation to a youth co-host to just them being so integrated into our service. It's just an outstanding event. So we try to just collaborate collectively together and make it exciting.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very good. I mean, that's hard to do sometimes, to reach out to youth, because, I mean, some youth think that adults, who cares, you know. But, I mean, that's tremendous that you can reach out and incorporate everybody into a service.
You know, that's one of the things that I guess I feel very proud about. When our fifth Sunday comes in and I have a young co-host, and he or she would sit there, and I would say, "Hi, my name is Gregory Geis," and they'd say their name, and we would just simply have this wonderful energy set forth. And then our small children church would come up and do maybe the daily word, or they'd come up and do our prosperity thought. And then we have a young Unitines, and they would do a praise dance, and they would flow into it. But when you take a young person, 14, 13, and they lead you in meditation, what it does for them is the most exciting part, because it allows them to go deep within themselves and set them in motion for something greater in their own lives. Mm-hmm. Because there's a trust level that takes place. And when they can take, with that music behind them, they go places they never knew they can go. And it takes the audience who were watching these young people to allow them to see that. And it's like, wow. And there's been times when I've done a message with them, with our young people, or that we even allowing them to be prepared to do a message, because we want them to realize that they are the future leaders, not only in the public life, but in the spiritual life. And only way they're going to be trusted to do that, when you open the doors and give them the opportunity to know that I trust you and you can do this. So that our fifth Sunday is a way for them to go on, and giving them encouragement. We have some excellent, wonderful, dynamic young people, and unless you encourage them and provide them with the opportunity, and Nina Scott has taken our adult choir to a higher level that was outstanding. And, you know, just recently we had Les Brown, who came in for our African Pride Sunday, and Les Brown did a magnificent service. We had our third Sunday in February was our African Pride Sunday. So we had our African drummers who opened it up, and they drummed, and they did a tremendous job, and Jerry Cousins and his crew. And we have a group of drummers with Dr. Kofense Chike, and he has taught them. But then Les came out, and I'm so grateful to Les Brown, because as you remember, Les Brown hasn't been around for a while.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Les Brown has given us a tremendous blessing and came out and gave a wonderful, soulful presentation that took place, and everyone so wonderfully just loved that experience, and it was just magnificent, and I was so appreciative of that. But our drummers were just unbelievably involved with that moment, the legendary Les Brown.
Yes, well, I remember when he had his TV show, and I mean, you know, that was very insightful at that time. But yes, he is a dynamic speaker, so I'm glad that he was able to really add something to the festivities and your celebration. That was great. And he came in, and I mean, he did the service himself, huh?
Yes. And you know, and he did it because he knew unity. He did it because he was, a friend of ours. I would like to thank all those who were involved in making sure he was able to come up here and do that. And it took a lot of people together who made it happen, from Diane Golden Lawson, from his personal team, you know, who Nina Bentley and others who made sure that he was able to get up here, because it took a lot. And God bless his family. You know, at that particular time, we was holding his son in prayer. But just to say thank you to Les, making sure that he was able to come up here and make all of that happen.
Yes, very, very kind of him, and I mean, that's great. Now, what are some of the principles of unity? Can you cover that?
Oh, yes. First of all, thank you for asking that question. Unity has what we call five basic principles. One principle I'd just like to cover is recognizing that there's only one presence and one power active in the universe: God, the good, omnipotent. So often we may get twisted, or you may call God Jehovah, another person may call God Allah, or some people may call God just simply the Most High. No matter what we call God, there's only one presence and one power. And then we also recognize that that presence lives within us, that God is that same presence, that same power exists within us as a universal force within us. We also believe in the idea of prayer and meditation. Prayer is so prevalent, and it exists within all faith-based orientations. And that is so important for all aspects. We
right.
see...
Well, again, you have a process to go through the meditation and prayer, and I'm assuming that's part of what you're referring to, correct?
Yes. When we talk about the prayer, this five-step prayer process, one of the first things we would tell a person is just to breathe and relax. And if I was speaking to a person right now, I would just say, take a deep breath. Just relax. Take time aside of your day each day for prayer, and that's what we truly believe. And when you begin to relax, your body begins to relax, and you will tell you to breathe deeply, knowing that you are in the presence of God, and the presence of God is within you, and to let go of all your concerns, and knowing that all is well. And I would tell you to concentrate. Simply close your eyes and release any thoughts of the world, and to go into that wonderful place within yourself. And then to take that moment to meditate, to allow this moment and to focus your mind on nothing but that centering presence of that life within you, and know that, as the master teacher says, be still and know that I am God. And from that deep understanding, to realize that the depth of your being is within you. And then there's this sense of gratitude, to give thanks that God is there for you at all times. This is that inner belief we try to teach, because when that takes over, when that begins to take hold of your very cells within the self, a tremendous magical moment happens. That's when Jesus recognized and have taught, or no matter what master teacher you may follow, it could be Buddha, it could be the Jesus, it could be the Christ presence that others may say, there becomes this wonderful energy itself that says that the Father and I are one, or all that God is, I am. But there becomes this great relationship that exists within you that is so tremendously. And that is what we try to teach. Before our service began, we have what we call a wonderful meditation moment from 9:15 to 9:45. Members of our church will go into a room, and we have a prayer team. John Mahato is a wonderful individual, and he's sort of along with our chaplains, and they lead our members who go there into a wonderful prayer circle. And they just sit there and meditate for a half hour. And then our service began, and we tried to create a very sacred half hour. And then we began our service, where we take a time to teach at a very deep level. You know, it's a good thing. You know, you're done with our service within an hour and 15 minutes, and it's be exciting. We go into some heavy thought ideas to create that moment, sacred moment within you.
Right. Well, that probably helps get everybody ready for the message that's being presented for that day, too, right? Yeah. Not only do they get insight into what's going on in their lives, but also it might open them up to new ideas that are presented later on in the actual lesson of the day, correct?
Yes, yes.
Now, I just want to remind everybody once again very quickly that this is WHFR.FM, Station Making Waves. This show is Metaphysically Speaking. I'm your host, Mike Holloway. This month, my special guest is Reverend Gregory Geis. He is the senior minister of Detroit Unity Temple and an author. And throughout his life, he's been a counselor, teacher, and social worker in the Detroit area. And along the way, he has also received many honors, including Michiganian of the Year from the Detroit News in 2008. How was that, receiving that? Was that a thrill?
The Michiganian of the Year?
Yes. That's got to be something special.
It was unexpected, and I'll share with you how I received that award. And what I mean by unexpected, it was because I didn't search for it, I didn't try to go out after it. And in 2007, my daughter was killed by a drunk driver. And she went down to Panama City. One of her friends who attended Michigan State University had been date raped, and my daughter was attending Purdue University. She was on the verge of graduating from Purdue, and her friend who had been date raped, she wanted to help her get over what was taking place, what had taken place. And she decided to drive to Panama City for a spring break, and this was her last year of school. So she came and visited me and told me she was going to Panama City. I never forget this. And I said, are you all right? You going down there? Her car was a car that I had bought for her. And I looked at the car and said, girl, you don't have no good tires to be driving down there like any good father.
Right.
So I took it to my friend and we bought new tires. And he came up and said, man, she don't have no oil in the car. So we wound up getting oil for the car. Next thing I know, he said, her lights inside's not working. So by the time I got new interior lights, new put oil in the car and gas and new tires, and she set off. And the last thing she told me, Dad, I don't think I'm coming back to Detroit. I said, why? She said, well, I just don't feel it. But she drove down there, and while she drove down there, she was sitting in her friends. There was four other individuals who went down there with her, and a young man who was drunk in Panama City came across a ridge and smashed and plowed right into them. I received a phone call that day, and as I received the phone call, the date was March the 16th, and they told me my daughter had been killed. But what they told me was really to call the coroner's office, or a person told me to call the police station. That's what they first told me. I called the police station, I identified who I was, and they redirected me to coroner's office or the morgue, and that person asked me to identify the body. And as I identified the body, you can imagine what the shock that went over myself when I had to identify my daughter, and because I knew her birthmarks, and then they told me that my daughter had lost her life in a car accident. That was the one time I know I lost my voice. And then I had to go through the painful ordeal of trying to get her body back up here.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to contact her mother and her sister and had to alert the family. And what led to this war was that through all that I had to go through, I never knew what the power of forgiveness was. Because I had to go down to Panama City. And, you know, we talk this spiritual principle of forgiveness. But until something is taken from you, a loss of life or somebody you love that you brought into this world, and you stand before a person, and I mean, it's easy to talk about forgiveness when it's not about something that was taken from you.
Mm-hmm.
And I stood before this young man, and I can see it vividly as I'm talking about it now, and I watched his family go before me as I was outside, and I knew it was him. I saw his parents, his mother, his father, and I didn't know if I could have ever done that, if you had asked me beforehand of that court date, if I could. But right in the moment, in the midst of that time period when we was going through that court proceeding, something struck me, and every stupid thing I had ever did in my life flowed in front of me. And I realized that the times when I had made a mistake. I thought about the times when I had drove through a gas station, or the times I was myself lubricated, and if it wasn't for the grace of God, I could have been on the other side of that chair. I thought about all the mistakes I made, and forgiveness flowed into my heart. If it wasn't for God, where I realized that what forgiveness was. And I forgave that young man. I forgave him because I had to forgive myself for all the things I did. And I'm not going to say it was easy, nor would I tell anyone else to do what I did. But I told him, you know, and he poured out tears like I had never seen before. But I forgave him. But I told him, I won't let you go. And that young man wrote me letters after letters after letters. He was given 12 and 12, 12 years of prison and 12 years of probation. And right about now, he should be getting close to getting out. But one of my church members wrote that story of forgiveness to the Detroit News. And they selected that story. So I was given that award because of the power of forgiveness that I extended. So it was not something, I guess, I sought. It was just a story that someone else felt and felt moved by, that they extended that award to me. So it was one of those moments that just became a God moment. It was something that I wouldn't tell anyone else to take on the challenge of doing, because it's not something you can ask someone else to do, because it's for each individual to make their own decision around. But for me, I learned that how powerful forgiveness is. And it freed me up, because I wouldn't, you know, I have these letters that this young man wrote over and over. And I went down to his city, and I visited his church and met his family and his minister. And we had workshops around the idea of forgiveness. I can never take away, you know, the pain that I felt, nor can he ever bring back to me what was taken. But I have used my daughter, that experience as a motivation for me. That led to the very first book that I ever wrote, The Courage to Conquer Fear. And as you know, we have shared some other stuff around that. But I realized some things, that there can never be anything that you can ever ask a person. Purdue University gave her degree, and we went down there, and they have a scholarship now named after my daughter. There's a place in Nigeria that has developed a scholarship named after my daughter. My lodge, Prince Hall, has a scholarship named after my daughter. It's something that I'm very grateful for, these points of memory that people have developed. But all I can ever do is continuously make something more. I'm very eternally grateful for my wife, who stood with me through this process. Her sister, my daughter, Maren Geis, who has elevated herself, it opened the door for her to grow even more. Sometimes when you lose somebody that you love, many things happen in this ripple of life that changes a person's consciousness around there, where though they may be gone from this physical plane, it creates a deeper level spiritually for all those who are involved. So I can never see the loss. It changes my concept, because I no longer see death as the way other people do. I only see growth into growth, or life into life. And her presence will always be there within me from that experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, my condolences and sympathy go to you and your family about that tragic event. But something that struck me as you were saying it is the fact that even though she's no longer here on the earth plane, she still had an impact around the world.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that's quite amazing, that even though that someone's gone, they still have an impact and still can affect people.
Oh, it affected a lot of people. Purdue came here. She was with Mosaic. She sang with Mosaic.
Okay.
So that moment of celebration, Mosaic was in that celebration. Purdue, she sang with Purdue, and they came in. And she has a YouTube video that she, because she was a singer, and she was a tremendous singer.
Mm-hmm.
Both of my daughters are singers, were singers, and she has a YouTube. She did Step by Step. So I'm just, to this very day, still very, very proud of what she brought to this world, of her talent and effort. So. Mm-hmm.
So you actually went up to this gentleman that caused your daughter's death, and you said that to him? I mean, it wasn't something you just thought about or, you know, I guess maybe hoped that he was getting the impression. You actually went up and told him that you
I'm just as close as I am to you.
Okay, and that's just about a couple feet, so
yeah, just
very close.
And I hugged him, and I released him, and I forgave him, you know, because I saw the fact that I was on that other side. If it wasn't for the grace of God, I had driven so many times intoxicated or been caught up in my young days, and if it wasn't for the grace of God, I could have been on that other side. It was only by, sometimes just by God touching me or awakening me, or sometimes we've all been in those places where an accident could have occurred, mm-hmm. and we may have taken someone's life if it wasn't been just for a moment of awakening or looking around or turning or missing a moment. Sometimes we don't realize that in our drunken state of foolishness when we were young, that could have been us.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw how many times I had been a fool as a young person, and I looked back and all those things flashed through my mind, and I just said, God. And I realized how easily I could have been there.
Mm-hmm.
And I became humbled and realized that this young man just, you know, his foolishness caught him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I forgave him, but I, you know, this young man, I just said, you know, you make it up to me by changing your life. You do something with your life. Don't make another error.
Right, or don't just, you know, give you lip service and say, oh, gee, I'm sorry, and then not do anything
but
about
it. But he had contacted me and talked about the things he'd experienced in prison, from rape, from being brutalized, and, you know, he was down there in Florida's prison, hardcore. He was in Florida's prison and had to go through prison life for 12 years. And so if you know you're a white male in Florida's prison and killed a young black girl, and what he experienced, and in his letters he had shared with me of being gang beaten, in his letters he had shared with me the tragic experience, and yet he's also shared with me of going for redemption and seeking to go towards counseling and trying to help others. And so he wrote me continuously trying to amend or acknowledge his regret. So whatever happens with his life, I couldn't hold on to unforgiven energy, because he now has to find a way of forgiving himself and moving on.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to continue with the journey of life, because my daughter, and as you would say, the metaphysically speaking, for myself is how to take that energy and use it to continuously build and enhance there, because I don't believe that there's a death. There's only an energy that I can take that and go forward, because I know that my daughter lives in another format.
Mm-hmm.
You see, when people talk about angels and they talk about God, she's my presence of a spiritual angel. I can communicate with her on levels that probably unknown to others,
mm-hmm.
because I don't see her in, I don't cancel her life experience because she no longer take a physical form. And I see her spiritual form all the time, and it's alive, it's a part. She's just as much a part of me as my mother, my father, who have transcended. She's mm-hmm. as much a part of me as if I can sit back and acknowledge Jesus Christ, who I never met, I can acknowledge her presence that's even greater, because I know her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was the one that gave life to her.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, I'm sure it's always hard for a parent to you know, lose a child because that's not the natural order of things. You know, it's usually the parent that goes before the child does, obviously. But that's tremendous that you're able to do that. I mean, I'm sure it's not easy.
No, it's not easy, man. But, I mean, it's the thing of this way of life in this world today that is becoming even more common, where parents are burying their children. We just don't have the answers because it's becoming so common. We see it as a normal reality. And we don't have ways of people speaking towards it or ways we can try to change the curve. And that's where what we have to do today, where when we were coming up, it was even a lesser reality. But today, in the African-American community particularly, as a common thread. I have many individual friends who are in the funeral home business, and it's almost like a norm where young men's lives are being taken at such an early age, and many young people are just so trapped in way of thinking that their lives are, this expectation that they may not live to be 25, this expectation that they live a life thinking that they may die sooner than their life is already past them. So we have to create an expectation to live to be our age. And they don't see that a lot of times, this expectation, you know, that they have to grab everything now because they may not be around, or parents hoping to see their children live just 30 or 40 or 50. And here we are in our eldership. And they only
I'm 62 myself, I'll admit that. But, getting back to something that I want to mention, too, that Reverend Geist has been kind enough to volunteer to speak at our upcoming Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair. And this is the third time that we've scheduled Reverend Geist for this event, and we hope everything works out this time. I know the first time there was death in your congregation, and you had to deal with that and take care of that. And then last year, you yourself had a medical emergency. Can you go into that? Again, this is what I want to get to. And
this is the closest I came to it.
Yeah, this is a tremendous. I mean, I didn't know the full story about your daughter. You had mentioned that to me prior to going on the air, but I didn't realize how deep it was. But can you explain what your situation was?
Metaphysically speaking, I'll go
Okay, that's what we're asking for.
Well, first of all, I want to thank, you know, Lynn, for allowing me for this third time. And as you know, every time we come around, it was an opportunity to have a chance to be on your show as well as be a part of the program. Last year, March the 14th, as I was preparing to be a part of it, I had the occasion to, I guess, be one of the few individuals to survive having a brain aneurysm. And that brain aneurysm occurred on March the 14th. I was unaware, and I guess if you want me, I'd share the story with you if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
I was at home, and most of you who are listening may know what a brain aneurysm is, but I was an individual who was extremely active, extremely involved. I suffered with migraine headaches at times, so I had been taking migraine headache medicine. And at this particular journey through the weeks leading up to this, I thought I was had the symptoms of a migraine headache, and I had went to my doctor telling him about what I, experiencing what I felt was another migraine that was seemed to be slightly different. And he increased the dosage in terms of preparation for a migraine. But it was slightly different. Instead of the floaters I would normally seeing, I was seeing a flashing that was on the perimeter of my eyes. And this particular morning, my wife was gone, and I was at home by myself. And as I woke up, I felt something unusual. I saw greater flashes on the perimeter of my eyes. And I wound up thinking it was a migraine that was about to unfold, and I went and took this medication. But this time, something happened. Excruciating pain began to just burst all around me, and I knew it wasn't a normal migraine because it was pain I had never felt before. And I went and quickly grabbed my phone, which was luckily it was in my room, bedroom, and I tried to dial my wife. When I got the phone, I felt myself immediately, felt like I was collapsing, and I grabbed the phone and I began to dial her number. And as I dialed her number, I could only say her name. And I called her name a couple of times, and I was found myself on the verge of blacking out. The pain was unbearable. And I was able to dial it again, and she kept calling my name, "What's the matter?" And I dialed it again because I must have either blacked out, but I woke up and I dialed it again. This time she just simply, according to her, dialed the police, dialed 911. And this is what she told me. She said, because I blacked out, I don't remember anything. And as the police, while I'm coming to the house, and they had to kick the door down, and when they kicked the door down, they wound up rushing me to Henry Ford Hospital in West Bloomfield, and the aneurysm had burst. And as the aneurysm burst, they had to take me to West Bloomfield and actually clip it, then rush me down to Detroit Henry Ford Hospital, and they had to perform emergency surgery. And as you know, if you don't know, they said very few can survive it. They discovered I had 3 aneurysms at that point, and the 3 aneurysms, and I was unconscious for that, from that period on, for at least 3 to 4 weeks. And I don't remember anything other than what my wife was telling me, that I was in Henry Ford Hospital at that time for until I began to wake up. What I do remember was as if I was between two worlds. I was in a state of limbo, it felt like. And in that state of limbo, as I've spoken to you about, it was like a gray mist. I remember being between two worlds. And it was like almost like a mist, a silver mist. I remember, even at that point, seeing my daughter we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I came out, merging back in my to my body. I don't remember being in Henry Ford Hospital, even though my wife said when I did merge, I came out talking about, where are my 5 wives?
Okay, you upped the number a little bit, right?
She said, I must have had 5 lives, I was trying to recall. But it was, I merged back into my body, and it was like, I had to learn how to walk again. I had to learn how to talk, how to eat again. They moved me from that point to another facility. And in that other facility, I had to learn everything all over again. And that was the bizarre, extreme situation. And it was the most mystical experience, because it became something from a peaceful experience, because I no longer felt this idea of death. I felt a peaceful experience because I saw, I had conversations with God. My daughter, seeing my daughter relieve any fear when I merged back in, but I realized that I am not my body. I realized that my body is a vehicle. I realized that, you know, there was a God connection that took place.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very powerful. And you said that you actually communicated with your daughter?
It was a telepathic spiritual experience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't that like where we're talking. It was like, it was a mystical experience. It was where our presence, her presence, was vibrant in a sense, almost like a silvery mystical presence. Her face were illuminated. It was a connection that I had with her, you know, that was drawn, but it wasn't like I was verbally talking. It was like just her presence was there.
Mm-hmm.
An illuminated presence that was there with me. And it was with me until I was able to merge back into my own body.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't say that we held conversations like we're sitting at a dinner table.
Right, right. It was just impressions you received. Like you said, it was telepathic.
I mean, you were
communicating, but you weren't actually speaking, per se.
It was just a presence of being.
Yes, that's a phenomenal story. And again, many people that I've read about and have talked to that have had near-death experiences often say that they're no longer afraid of death because they understand it as being just a part of life, and your soul goes on, but your body is left behind, and it goes on to a new vehicle, and you continue on.
That coming back into the body, that was the peaceful awareness that I had. I no longer had this idea that death is some endless journey. As a matter of fact, the idea of the word itself no longer fit. I see it as life into life, a wonderful continuation. And it was almost as if God had prepared me to have that understanding as I served as a chaplain in a community in a program called Ascensions. And serving as a chaplain, I knew why I felt I was a midwife, helping a person make that spiritual journey from one experience to the next. So now I can connect the dots, and I truly know that it is life into life. I truly know that our body is a vehicle, that holy presence, that I am, that serve within us, that consciousness of who we are is there within us. And I understand that how blessed we are to have this vehicle, mm-hmm. and how we should take care of it. But it is not who we are. It is just that vehicle that God has given us. What a blessing.
Right. Amazing story. Unfortunately, we're going to have to kind of end it there. Very quickly, how can people reach you?
Well, they can reach me by calling our phone number. But we're located at Detroit Unity Temple, 17505 2nd Avenue in Detroit, Michigan. Our phone number is 313-345-4848. Our address, once again, is 17505 2nd Boulevard in Detroit, Michigan, 48203. Phone number 313-345-4848. Our Sunday service takes place every Sunday at 10 o'clock. We're only there for an hour till 11 o'clock. Everyone is more than welcome. We have some outstanding upcoming programs. And all the way through February, we have an outstanding quilt taking place, a community quilt that's over 30 feet long. And truly, I hope to see you. We have Ellis Liddell coming in, who our speaker for February the 26th. And I love to see you there. And thank you again.
Reverend Geist, thank you very much. It's been amazing. I really appreciate you being able to do this. And the fact that we are looking forward to seeing you at the Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair.
I look forward to being there this time.
Yeah, okay. Let's knock on wood, right? But thank you very much, Reverend. I appreciate it.
All right. God bless you. Thank you.
Well, I just want to thank my special guest for this month, Reverend Gregory Geist. He is the senior minister of Detroit Unity Temple, and I do appreciate him being here. Very, very interesting. I was a little sad or a little, I don't know, frustrated.